Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, see our videos on YouTube, and catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Nick Tedesco, Senior Philanthropic Advisor for J.P. Morgan Private Bank's Philanthropy Center, and your moderator for the program. I'm now pleased to introduce our speakers, Dr. David Callahan, founder of the Demos Think Tank and InsidePhilanthropy.com, and author of the new book, The Givers, Money, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age, and Dr. Emmett Carson, president of the Silicon Valley Community Foundation. David Callahan holds a PhD in politics from Princeton and is the author of 7 previous nonfiction books, including The Cheating Culture, Why More Americans Are Doing Wrong to Get Ahead, and Fortunes of Change, The Rise of the Liberal Rich and the Remaking of America. His latest investigation focuses on what he calls the secretive world of elite philanthropists and how they're quietly wielding more and more power to shape American life in ways both good and bad. While media attention focuses on famous philanthropists such as Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and Charles Koch, Dr. Callahan says thousands of donors are at work below the radar, promoting a wide range of causes, converting fortunes into influence with deep impact on government policy and ultimately all of us. To give his perspective on the philanthropic world, we're also pleased to have Dr. Emmett Carson, president and founding CEO of the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, now with over $8 billion in assets. The foundation is the nation's largest community foundation, whose funds support a wide range of causes around the world. Dr. Carson brings with him a distinguished 12-year career as CEO of the Minneapolis Foundation, and prior to that, oversaw the Ford Foundation's U.S. and global grant-making program on philanthropy and the nonprofit sector. Dr. Carson holds master's and PhD degrees from Princeton University. Please welcome David Callahan and Emma Carson. So we hope to have a very interactive discussion today. So as the announcer mentioned, please make sure to fill out your cards. We'll be taking those questions as we begin and continue the dialogue. So David, first, congratulations on another powerful book. Your work in this book and beyond really provides greater transparency for the sector and begs a number of really great and important questions. I thought we'd begin today by setting the stage. I'd love to talk a little bit about who the new givers are and how they're different. So what are their strategies and approaches, and how does it differ from those that we've seen come before them?
Well, thank you, and thanks for that introduction. And thank you to the Commonwealth Club. It's really great to be back here. I love this institution, and this is my, I guess, third time here, and it's always a pleasure. And thanks to Nick and Emmett Carson in particular, who is really leading one of the most interesting institutions in philanthropy right now. So on to this question of who are the new givers. You know, one thing I've learned in tracking all these givers is you have to be really careful about generalizing. You know, we tend to think of the new givers as being, you know, these 34-year-old Silicon Valley whippersnappers with all these big ideas and all this tech money. In fact, the average age on the Forbes 400 list is 64, and a great many of those people are turning to philanthropy, and many of those people are new to philanthropy. They spent decades amassing great fortunes, and not necessarily, you know, in tech or finance, but often in the old economy. You know, they made billions of dollars in retail or shipping or fossil fuels or mining and extraction or, you know, all sorts of things that maybe you haven't quite thought about before. And now an increasing number of them are turning to philanthropy. That said, I do think that these Silicon Valley donors have been an extremely kind of visible face of the new philanthropy. And they are pretty interesting in terms of their desire to kind of swing for the fences, many of them, to make big bets, to start giving early, to, you know, you make your money in tech by coming up with some big idea that's going to change the world. And a lot of them have brought that sensibility to philanthropy. And that's one of the things that's so exciting to watch right now as these people set out, you know, the super empowered individuals set out to try to solve big problems, get rid of disease, you know, conquer poverty in developing countries. I mean, it's a very exciting time mm-hmm. right now in philanthropy, maybe the most exciting time ever in the history of modern philanthropy in the United States.
You know, it's interesting. I think the point you made about kind of what's old is new, you know, there's a cyclical nature to this. And Emmett, I would love to hear your thoughts on when we really started to see kind of this generation of philanthropists begin to give in the approach that David so, you know, aptly described. And is this all altogether unique from what we saw from, you know, the early days of philanthropy with, you know, Ford, Rockefeller, Carnegie? Is this a distinct moment in time, or is this cyclical?
Well, let me start by saying thanks to the Commonwealth Club. I'm glad to be here with David and Nick. I do think that it is a different period of time than what we had in the past. I think the new philanthropists, David was saying, they go deep rather than broad. They tend to have maybe two or three issues and not 10 to 20 as the old philanthropists had. They are far more engaged and involved. They are learners with the work, as opposed to saying, well, I trust in this nonprofit executive. They meet with them once a year and come back a year later, and I'll give you an incremental grant. They give large grants. They do swing for the fences. I think that they, by and large, are not comfortable with foundations as a structure. Mm-hmm. So Bill and Melinda Gates may be among the last very wealthy to have a foundation in the same structure. They look for other ways for a whole number of reasons. They are different from the past as well in that they are giving while they are living as a general rule. They're not waiting until they end their work career to engage in giving. They're doing it at the same time. So I think there are a lot of important differences between the old legacy givers and the newer givers as illustrated by some of the tech donors in Silicon Valley.
What do you both think the implications are for legacy foundations with these trends?
Well, I think that many of them are pretty scared of sort of seeing their world disrupted by these newcomers. Yeah. You know, I wrote an article entitled "Philanthrosaurus Rex: Why the Age of Big Foundations is Almost Over," in which I basically said, you know, the big foundation is very much a kind of creature of mid-20th century industrialism, right? That the people who created the first modern foundations, Rockefeller, Carnegie, these are people who built large industrial organizations, you know, Standard Oil, U.S. Steel. And when they turned to philanthropy, they built large, you know, institutions, hierarchical, centralized, top-down. Business is very different today. Much more likely to do things in a decentralized fashion. You outsource out, you focus on your core competency, and many of the donors who are coming out of that new business world are taking that mm-hmm. approach to philanthropy. And I think the Silicon Valley Community Foundation is a great example of this. This institution has exploded because so many donors of today are interested in these donor-advised funds, and which are much more flexible. That they don't want to have their own staff. It's a different way of doing business.
There is I think we want to counterbalance the legacy institutions and the new philanthropists, rather than thinking about it as an ecosystem of philanthropy. So in that, there's also crowdfunding and other vehicles for giving. So there's a whole ecosystem of giving. Part of the tension comes from many of these individuals, these younger tech donors or older, because mm-hmm. David's very right on point about their different industries that's developing new wealth. The difference is they are the founders. And founders act more decisively. They're willing to take bigger risks because they're the founders. So if you would compare the founders of today with the founders of yesterday, what Carnegie did, what Rockefeller did, what Kellogg did, you'd see a whole lot of similarities in their willingness to take risks and think big. But when you compare legacy institutions with administrative staff, they are far more reserved in how they manage and think about risk and reputation as the founders themselves are and what they're willing to do. And that's one of the reasons why many of these founders don't want to create the same kind of legacy institutions. They fear that they won't have the same risks, won't take on the same big topics, and many of them are saying they're going to spend down or spend out either in their lifetimes or within a period of time after the last person passes away.
Yeah, I would love for you both to touch on a little bit of the structure. So you mentioned that the traditional foundation is weaning a bit in interest from living donors in terms of creating it. We're seeing the rise of hybrid entities, LLCs, donor advised funds are obviously very popular. What are the implications of that? And what's driving that in terms of, is it flexibility? Is it they're giving while living? Mm-hmm. You know, what are some of the implications around why there's structural differences now? And you touched on a few of them already.
Right. Well, just to make one comment, I don't want to be seeming like we're beating up on the legacy foundations because at Inside Philanthropy, we cover a lot of legacy foundations that are doing phenomenal work and many of them say, you know, we are taking, you know, Darren Walker, the head of the Ford Foundation, says, David, I take big risks all the time, you know, place big bets all the time. You know, so they're very sensitive to being cast as the kind of not with it, you know, the dowdy has-beens who don't know how to get things done. A lot of them feel like, wait a minute, you know, we've been doing this for many, many decades. We do know how to get things done. We have staffers who've worked in the trenches on social, all sorts of these issues for many years, whereas you upstarts who you know, parachute in from the business world like you, you know, you have a lot to learn from us. So I just want to make clear that, you know, we're not against the Fords of the world. And to the question of you know, why the structures are changing, I think that the giving while living, that many of these people, these donors are starting young, they don't necessarily have the time to, you know, set up a freestanding foundation, staff it, run it, and many of them want to remain nimble. So maybe they'll change their, you know, you change your mind, you need a different structure and staff, but if you set an institution, it can be hard to then change direction. Mm-hmm. So they want to kind of keep the options open and make this all kind of compatible with their day jobs.
It's interesting. I wonder, too, if as a sector we continue to mature and services are available that were not available, you know, even 10 years ago, certainly not 20 or 30 years ago. You know, David, to your point about outsourcing a lot of these solutions, I don't think that there was the support, the ecosystem to be able to outsource a lot of this. So you had to build a robust infrastructure and it had to be insourced. It had to be controlled by you. And now there's a lot of intermediaries that are leveraging that work on your behalf.
I would add in, if you could step back for a moment and think that you're in your 30s and you've got billions of dollars and you've made a commitment to get engaged in philanthropy. Boy, that is an amazing thought. Just hold that thought for a minute. And you're looking out over time and you're saying you have 40 to 50 years of a cycle in which you want to give. And you don't know how the laws might change relative to giving. You don't know how societal opportunities will change over that period of time. The LLC becomes a very compelling vehicle because it gives you a lot of options to do good. Mm-hmm. A private foundation gives you one option to do good. I give a grant to something called a 501c nonprofit, and that's the way I do good. I can't engage in any other way to do good other than this preset way. But if I believe that I want to start a business that may have a social good for it, public benefit company, if I believe I want to engage in advocacy, if I believe I want to do any number of other things that can do good, a private foundation constrains my ability to do those things. So if I'm looking in this long time horizon with a lot of wealth, understanding laws can change over time, I would want to have the most flexible vehicle to do my giving, because that keeps all of my options open over a period of time. So that I do think that's another reason why the private foundation structure is not as popular today as it was in the past. But also those founders are reaching the decision. And look, I was trained at Ford, and the legacy institutions do great, important work, but they don't make $100 million bets on a regular basis. Right? That's just not how they're wired to do. And I'm not saying that's wrong or right, but if you want to make big impact to a few topics, you look at any legacy institution in their programmatic areas, and you see 20 to 30 different things that they fund. And again, I'm not saying that's wrong, but if my mindset is to be narrow and deep, that isn't the place that I find comfort in that structure, both in how it works and also in terms of its limitations and how to do good.
It's interesting. I wonder if either of you have an opinion. I believe that the LLC and the hybrid structures, you know, you've got to look across your balance sheet. You know, all capital should be working towards the social good. Are we going to be trading infrastructure of the foundation for infrastructure of an LLC, a for-profit? And, you know, when you look at things like the Ford or Gates Foundation, when you've got, you know, 1,500 staff members in a foundation, are we trading that, and now are there going to be 1,500 staff members staffed at your LLC? And then there's going to be criticism on the back end of that. Because somebody's got to do the work. And so there's going to be a piece of this where, you know, regardless of where you sit, there's got to be somebody that actually does the work. I don't know if either of you have an opinion on that.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing about making bigger bets and giving out larger chunks of money as opposed to slicing and dicing, a lot of these legacy foundations, as Emmett mentioned, they have many different programs and they give lots of small grants. The Ford Foundation, I think last year or the year before, gave 1,000 grants, you know, and many of them are for $100,000, $50,000. And you look at this and you're like, how can you achieve any impact when you slice and dice your grant making so narrowly? And you look at all those program officers, and that's what they're doing. They're chasing after these little grants. And so I've been quite critical of legacy foundations for that. And one of my hopes and thoughts is that when you're giving out bigger chunks of money, you do need a somewhat leaner capacity. You don't need as much capacity, but you certainly will need some capacity. And, you know, the LLCs, Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan got a lot of attention for creating an LLC. Lorraine Powell Jobs is doing her giving through an LLC. I have not myself seen a massive explosion of LLCs. A lot of people continue to gravitate toward DAFs. Plenty of foundations are still being created. Mm-hmm. 30,000 private foundations have been created since the year 2000, right? So it's not like the private foundation is really Philanthrosaurus Rex yet, but trends seem to be going in that direction.
You know, you had mentioned big bets, both of you, and I think this is something that we all have observed as a trend in the sector that hopefully is really catalyzing change and you know, taking a lot of risk and informing a lot of future work. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of big bets, and is it either you make big bets or you are making smaller grants to build a field? Are they mutually exclusive? Should we be moving away from smaller grants towards big bets? Or is there a place for both of them in the world of kind of the new generation of giving?
I mean, I think if you want to make big change, you need to make some big bets. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why this has become so popular, is these people do want to make big change. So,
no, I think it's both and, right? It's an ecosystem. And I do think, I tell the analogy, my dad used to take me fishing, and he would say, you've got to have the right rod and the right reel and the right tackle and the right bait, right? And so They're different nonprofits. They're scaled at a different size. There's a donor for that scale of nonprofit for that gift. If you've got 20 kids after school, that's one scale of program versus somebody who's trying to do something on a national basis that's transformative. And I don't think every donor needs to be transformative. Every donor doesn't have to be for direct charitable services. You can be both, either, and all at the same time. And so there's this ecosystem. And I think sometimes, yes, people with the elite donors, the elite wealth, they think more about big transformative change because they have the resources to think in those terms. But we should not think all of philanthropy then falls into that big transformative bucket. And I've met equally wealthy people who don't have a yearning to be necessarily transformative, but they do want to be impactful. And I think that's another thing that separates many of these newer donors. They're about metrics and outcomes and data. Mm-hmm. And that also sometimes makes our nonprofit communities uncomfortable with some of those questions.
Just to, if I could piggyback on that for a second. So at Inside Philanthropy, we cover a lot of higher ed giving to universities and colleges. And that's a kind of very traditional type of giving. You know, you write a big check to your alma mater. And that kind of giving has totally exploded. Mm-hmm. There was 194 gifts last year, a record number of gifts over $10 million. And, you know, there's a lot of people who find themselves with a lot of money and who don't necessarily have big ideas. As Emmett says, they're not out to, you know, abolish malaria or teach third grade kids how to read. They just want to do some. A lot of them just want to give back. You know, the Giving Pledge has this great, which Nick was involved in, the Giving Pledge, which is the Warren Buffett, Bill Gates initiative to encourage billionaires to participate in philanthropy. There's a great sort of archive of letters of all these people, over 150 of them, who have joined the Giving Pledge, who've explained their motives, why they're pledging to give away at least half their wealth. And it's fascinating reading because so many of these people feel an intense sense of gratitude for the opportunities they've had, and they really want to give back. And people define that in different ways. And a lot of them define it as, I'm just going to write a big check to the university where I went. And it's easy if you're, you know, one of these sophisticated thinkers about philanthropy to deride that as this kind of very simplistic giving, especially when that money is going to a place with a $30 billion endowment, but like Harvard. But in fact, it's how a lot of people think, and I'm not, you know, it's. I try not to be critical of that, and just to kind of take these people on their own terms. It's important too.
Well, and I also think it's a symptom of providing philanthropists with the tools and resources to be effective in their giving, mm-hmm. and I think that's where hopefully the sector is maturing, because, you know, to your point, the work that Bridgespan has been doing around big bets, it's pretty interesting to see the number of big bets made last year. You know, so vast majority of them are going to education, higher education institutions, because I think, to your point, it's easier to do that rather than understanding what it takes to make a transformative big bet in the social sector outside of that. So, you know, it might also be a commentary right on the sector, which is fascinating. I'm going to go to a question.
Yeah, it's much easier, by the way, to give $100 million. These institutions can absorb $100 million in the way that social change organizations cannot.
Right. I want to take a question from the audience, and I think this will spark a lively debate amongst you both. Please comment on Spend Down Philanthropy and the work of Chuck Feeney as an example of impact. So I would love to put that question to the both of you. Is giving while living, the pros and cons and the merits of limited life versus giving in perpetuity?
Why don't you, it's easy to me. I think donors get to choose. I don't put a value judgment on it. If a donor believes that they can be most effective that way, great. If they feel they want to create something that's in perpetuity, great. I don't see a need to say one is bad and the other is good. Philanthropy is intensely personal. So I just think that a lot of people have a lot of energy over that debate that I myself don't have.
And I am not an absolutist on this issue either. However, I do share the kind of quizzical or bewilderment in some cases of some of these new donors who, these people are in an urgent rush to solve problems, and they can't believe that anybody would go for a kind of a slower perpetuity type road. Tim Gill, who I profile in my book, who's one of the great kind of leaders in LGBT philanthropy, said to me, if you're trying to solve a social problem, you should use all your resources to do it. And you shouldn't, think that you're going to solve the problem. You're going to take a 50-year approach to, certainly on an issue like LGBT rights. I'm frustrated, for example, of the funders who are trying to solve the problem of climate change. And if ever there was a ticking clock on a major challenge, it's climate change, right? It drove me crazy when the presidents of the Hewlett and Packard Foundations, who, great institutions, wrote a joint op-ed sort of calling philanthropy to arms to fight climate change, saying this is the existential threat facing civilization in our time. Everybody should put more resources into this issue, as both those institutions have for sure. But apparently, abiding by the 5% payout rule for those institutions is more important than the urgency of really trying to. I think those institutions should be, if you really believe climate change is a problem, spend down half the endowment if you have to really try to move the needle, because, some of these foundations, many foundations, could literally be underwater in the United States in a century. I wanted to do a map at Inside Philanthropy where we would chart the sea level rises over the next 150 years as projected by scientists and chart where the foundations are. And you know what? Literally, foundations are going to have to evacuate. But they don't. On the other hand, if your mission is promoting arts and culture and education in the city of Boston, I profile the Hostetters, who created the Barr Foundation, in my book, and they chose the perpetuity model because their sense is that they care about Boston. It's the focus of their giving. Their sense is that, look, Boston is always going to have needs, and we want the Barr Foundation to always be there for Boston. And I get that. So this is why I am not an absolutist on this issue.
And I would say, I agree with David that foundations need to be intentional. And I could make an equally valid case, I think, that regardless of what happens, climate change is going to be a long-term problem, and I may want to have some resources to be around as that evolving problem is being challenged, and I could spend out everything in 1 year and not necessarily move the needle, and then as a catalyst, I'm not around to catalyze. So, right, but you want people to be intentional, I think, in how they reach that decision. But I don't think we can have this absolutist, you ought to do this or you ought to do that, and that's the best path to take.
And I wonder, is a big part of this also understanding what is needed for the current problem? And we always talk about in this sector listening to your grantees and listening to the field. And so as a part of this, a reaction of adjusting your approach as you understand the need, the issue, or the implementing partners on those issues. Mm-hmm. I wanted to touch on an interesting question that you pose in the book about the clout and power wielded. So does philanthropy threaten civic equality and democracy?
So this is an important and big theme of my book, which is that over the past few decades, as economic inequality has risen, it has translated in a lot of different ways into civic and political inequality. And it makes that is intuitively makes sense, right? I mean, wealthy people have outsized resources derived economically, and those resources find their way into other spheres of life. And we now have a voluminous amount of evidence of how economic inequality is translated into civic and political inequality. We're most familiar with how this has happened in political life. There's been a lot of writing about the influence of money in politics and all these mega donors and super PACs and all of that, and how, as a result, the ordinary citizens have less voice and less power.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And what I suggest in my book is that philanthropy, for all of its good intentions, is becoming another way, another place where economic inequality is translating into civic inequality. The wealthy donors are not the bad, are not the villains in my story. Rather, it is the system which allows them to use their wealth to convert their wealth into political and societal influence, particularly over foreign over public policy. So I look at a lot of examples of donors who've been quite, I mentioned Tim Gill, you know, the LGBT donors were very strategic, very focused, and very effective at kind of accelerating the pace of the marriage equality movement and the LGBT rights movement overall. The climate donor, Michael Bloomberg, has been an incredibly effective a giver on that issue, backing the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign and shutting down numerous coal-fired plants. The conservative donors over the last three decades have built an incredibly powerful infrastructure of think tanks that have shaped fiscal policy and social policy and economic policy in Washington. There's a lot of examples. My book is filled with them of donors who have converted their economic resources into political clout. My view is that if you're one of the people who worries about money in politics, you need to also be looking at how philanthropy is being sort of used in that way. I talk about three different tributaries of money in politics. There's the campaign money, there's the lobbying money, and there's all the money that goes to think tanks, litigation groups, advocacy organizations, and the like. And that money, A, is just as big as all the, there's just as much of it as those other better forms of money. And B, it's often more effective because it operates upstream. It shapes the agenda. It decides which ideas are sort of debated. And if we have to talk about it, and it's an inconvenient subject, and it's hard to figure out what to do, but I try to sort of open up that conversation.
So I agree with David that we've got widening economic inequality, and as he said, the villain is the system that we have that creates it. And philanthropy is one outgrowth that people use to deal with the fact they've accumulated wealth. I think that's a good outgrowth. Where I differ with David is I'm not as sure about what philanthropy's role is around his term of civic inequality. And this is what I mean by that. Philanthropy is an expression to me of our democracy, right? It's an expression of democracy. We give to the things we believe in. We give to the causes and value propositions that we support. In David's view, I think I'm right in saying that ACLU shouldn't be supported right now. We shouldn't be able to get a charitable deduction to do that work. I think that work is really important in this environment so I can express my part of democracy. Others are supporting other organizations that express their view of democracy. And democracy is messy. Democracy isn't uniform. We don't share a world view about how that works. I would go even further to say every time we make a grant, there is a value judgment in that grant about what went wrong. And either there was the individual that needed to be fixed, or there was the system that needed to be fixed. But this is just an expansion of democracy that fights itself out. And there are grants that are made to support causes and worldviews that I firmly disagree with. But I think those people ought to be able to support those causes in the same way that I want to write my check to support the things that I believe in. That's an expression of our democracy. And I think once you get into saying some expressions are okay and some aren't, that's a slippery slope that will lead to defunding, if you will, of philanthropy across the board. Because I don't know where you start to draw the line about, well, these art exhibits have the values that I like, and these art exhibits don't have the values that I think ought to be supported. I think you just go down a hill where you don't end.
Can I please respond to that? Yeah. So this all sounds nice. You know, Emmett is voicing a view that you'll hear many philanthropists themselves voice. So I went and talked to Eli Broad, who's one of the top funders in the charter of the charter school movement. And, you know, I asked him this question about democracy, and he said, well, you know, we're expanding the debate. Teachers' unions have dominated the debate. We're sort of putting more options on the table. Sounds reasonable enough. The problem with this sort of pluralism, what I call the pluralism defense of big philanthropy, is that the people who are deciding which options on the table are different from the population writ large. Like, this would all be a fine system, as Emmett describes it, if in fact the wealthy were a perfect mirror of the rest of the country. But there's, in fact, a lot of research which suggests that, as you may have heard, the rich really are different from us, from you and me. And they're different in a number of ways. For one thing, they tend to be more economically conservative. Survey research shows that you ask the wealthy about any number of economic issues, free trade, minimum wage, labor regulation, financial regulation, that they tend to have more conservative views than the average American. They're also often more socially liberal and more ecologically minded. The problem with a kind of civil society where the wealthy are the people putting the options on the table is that it doesn't end up necessarily reflecting what options would be on the table if everybody was choosing. And charter schools are great examples. So there's been a huge influx of funding into the education K-12 space over the past 15 years. And most of that money has gravitated to choice, accountability, kind of options for improving schools. Very little of that money has gone to finance other approaches like to deal with the persistent racial segregation of our schools, which reflects residential patterns of segregation. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other things that you might do to attack our K-12 problems, but the donors who come and have favored a certain set of options, and that's the debate we've gotten.
Well, and they've also favored Common Core. Mm-hmm. So again, we can pick and choose and say, I don't like a particular topic, but I don't know that the answer is to say philanthropy should no longer engage in the public square as the answer. Right.
And I guess I would ask the question of, has philanthropy pushed the agenda, you know, in one way or the other, liberal, you know, progressive or conservative? But are there examples where a philanthropist or a group of philanthropists have successfully kind of unilaterally pushed that agenda? And that's, I think, something that would be great to touch on a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll do another question and we could...
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people want to know what are some examples of these big bets that are trending in behavior patterns of putting a lot of money into programs. Have they been successful? Are there any that we can point to that have come out and actually produced some meaningful results?
Well, a lot of them are kind of pretty new and ongoing. So the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative recently launched its big effort to try to eliminate or cure all diseases or manage diseases by the end of the 21st century. We won't know the results of that one for many decades to come. One big bet I think that we can point to as a clear success is Michael Bloomberg's big bet on the Beyond Coal campaign, which, as I said, I discuss in my book. So Bloomberg is the biggest donor ever, you know, in the history of the Sierra Club. He's given the Sierra Club $130 million to kind of go shut down coal plants all over the place. And it's been phenomenally successful. He, in fact, is one of my favorite, I think one of the most effective donors of our time. Bloomberg has also made a huge couple huge bets in public health in the developing world to reduce traffic deaths and also reduce deaths from cigarettes, tobacco use. He's put about $600 million into that last one, and he's saving, his philanthropy is saving lots of lives. We could talk about Bill Gates. Yeah. You know, I like to say that when it comes to big bets, there's high-hanging fruit and low-hanging fruit, and you know, the big bets that work out are often those that go after the lower hanging fruit. You know, we know how to reduce deaths from tobacco or traffic, you know, road accidents. We know how to vaccinate children. But K-12 education, for example, is a notorious graveyard of ambitious philanthropy. And medical, one after the other. And medical research is also extremely extremely difficult, although there's some real successes you can point to in that field as well. One of the donors that I look at is Herb and Marion Sandler, who put a huge amount of money, ultimately $100 million, behind research on asthma, which before they came along had been this kind of neglected public health issue that didn't draw any top researchers. They came along and revolutionized research on asthma by using their money to bring in all sorts of top talent, make all sorts of breakthroughs. We made tremendous progress on asthma.
It's very early, as David was saying, and I would just remind everyone that typically the home run champions are also the leaders in strikeouts. And so right there it's not a better approach, it's a different approach that adds to the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on this, but I would point to the campaign to eradicate polio that Bill and Melinda have embarked on with, you know, about 15 other peer philanthropists, and you know that's $1.4 billion that's been deployed in the last 4 years. That is very close to eradicating a disease that was largely forgotten, and I think that's very emblematic of a lot of the behavior patterns you both had touched on. But also a success in a big bet, really looking at deploying resources to move the mark on it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions we got from the audience here is, given that this is a new Gilded Age, what are the chances that philanthropy will and can address social, racial, and economic inequality? We're certainly hearing that from Emmett, you know, your former, you know, foundation, the Ford Foundation. I mean, there's a lot of focus on inequality now as a theme of work. So what are the chances that this is going to be successful?
Well, those are three different buckets. And so my short answer is it's unlikely that philanthropy will be able to meaningfully address that. I say that with sadness and regret. And I say that because I look at philanthropy's own actions. We're not a diverse industry in terms of the board members. We're not diverse in terms of the staffing. We're not diverse with where our money goes today. And so to ask a group that doesn't reflect diversity to be the champion of diversity in a national debate seems not to be the place to place that experience. I wish that were different, but I think there are the few exceptions to the rule. Of champions in this space, but they're few and far between in an environment that's more polarized to do this work than ever before. And so it is not an area today where you can tread in as you could less than a year ago and work in this space. It is a very highly charged space to work in today. And the kinds of changes that will need to be made on the economic inequality front and the structural front, particularly with regard to how technology is going to affect our nation. The real issue to the dislocation, from my perspective, is not trade with China, it's not undocumented immigrants from other countries, it's a technological revolution and transformation that we are woefully unprepared for at every level. And that goes from not just driverless cars, it goes to medical diagnoses that are coming, taxes that are being done by machines. The level of AI disruption and robotic disruption in manufacturing will have significant consequences for how we live, work, and play in this society. And we aren't having that conversation, and that is a conversation philanthropy is uniquely positioned to help communities dialogue, research, convene around, and we're only now starting to understand and talk about that.
And I would just, you know, reinforce some of Emmett's points by saying that, I mean, philanthropy has done a terrible job of trying to address economic inequality. Think of the drivers of economic inequality. Technological change and automation, philanthropy has basically had no traction on that at all. Globalization and free trade, I have written about how philanthropy, almost no funders work in that area at all. I mean, I once tried to raise money for a project in that area, and there's almost nobody works on globalization and trade issues or funds in that area. And then think of the third area, which is public, third driver of inequality, which has been public policy changes that favor the owners of capital and employers, gutting the whole sort of regulatory structures set up in the New Deal. For example, around employment, to make it easier to bust unions and outsource work and turn good jobs into bad jobs in the name of corporate profits. Very few funders have been willing to wade into those labor issues and try to put their thumb on the scale. The Ford Foundation has been one of them that's been most creative in this area and has done quite a bit. Almost none of the new donors coming in to philanthropy now are thinking about these issues. I mean, the reason that there's so much inequality for these low-wage workers is because they can't get their productivity goes up, their wages have remained flat, all the gains go to the owners of capital, and because so many of the new philanthropists coming in are business people who sort of relate to and have benefited from the status quo and are coming, you know, they are the owners of capital. And so they're not the people who are contesting that status quo. And until they do, all of their efforts to help, you know, inner city school kids and these different pilot projects and this and that, mentoring programs and whatever, are going to amount to very little.
I would just make one nuanced difference with David on this. I don't think this is about the new givers versus the legacy givers. I think this is about philanthropy as a field as a whole has been missing on this. And I don't think it falls on an onus for people who get a whole lot of people to spend 99 cents to create an app and they get hundreds of thousands of people to give them 99 cents on it, right? That's a new business. That's new wealth being created. I think philanthropy is a product of capital. So it is difficult for all philanthropy to talk about this transformation. And yet, unless we find the will to start to talk about this transformation and how it will impact, it will have enormous negative repercussions for the our society. And we're already seeing it. It's just misdirected at, in my mind, the wrong things today. Right? People are angry. They're just focused on the wrong things. And so we've got a window of time to focus people on what what is the cause of the disruption and what is the cause of the inequality. The coal mines aren't coming back. The factory jobs aren't coming back. And that's not just because mean capital is trying to be efficient. The economy is restructuring in fundamental ways, in ways that it has never restructured before. And we aren't having that conversation about what that will mean for how people will live. And the gig economy is not a solution to that, right? So that it's a bigger, more massive question than people trying to take advantage of labor. Jobs are simply going away and being displaced because you don't go to retail stores anymore. You don't go to brick and mortar. You go and click online with the one-click button, and so you don't go to those stores. So the people in retail don't have those jobs anymore. That's not wealthy capitalists manipulating you. That's preferences and changes to our economy and our society that we aren't talking about. But hold all of philanthropy accountable for that, not just one segment of philanthropy accountable.
There are a number of questions in here about accountability more broadly, and I would love to transition over to talk about, should philanthropy be more accountable to the American public, and if so, how?
Well, so before I started writing about philanthropy, I wrote a lot about ethics and professional ethics and wrote a book called The Cheating Culture. In fact, one of the previous times I was here was to talk about my book, The Cheating Culture, which looked at the way in which one sort of sector in America after the other over the past 20 years or so ran into accountability problems. Many of these sectors, like the accountants before Enron and WorldCom, or like Major League Baseball before the steroid epidemic, many of these sectors said, when people came with regulatory ideas, they said, don't worry, we got it covered. The accountants throughout the 1990s said, oh no, we are keeping an eye on the professional standards to make sure that nothing bad can ever happen. And then we get WorldCom and Enron, the two biggest bankruptcies in U.S. history, which were brought about because of systematic earnings frauds, while accountants looked the other way because they were getting fat consulting contracts. And I could go on with a bunch of other examples, Major League Baseball, universities, another area. I don't want to see, my concern is that sort of philanthropy is where some of these other sectors were, basically saying, you know, sort of keeping its head down, we don't want to be regulated, go away with your ideas for more regulation, we got it covered, philanthropic freedom is this great absolutist value, we're, you know, making such a contribution, we don't need any rules. And I don't think that that can last, because someday the accountability juggernaut is going to show up at the door of modern philanthropy, and it's going to when it happens, the last time it happened was in the late 1960s, and it had a very populist tinge to it. And it was brought about because of sort of two things that were happening. One, more politicized philanthropy by the likes of the Ford Foundation and other activist donors that attracted criticism. And two, outdated regulations which allowed a lot of loopholes and abuses of the system. And that produced a crackdown, congressional hearings, the whole thing. And it would be nice if we didn't have to go through that again, because the sector kind of gets ahead of the curve and embraces some ideas for greater oversight and accountability.
Yeah, as a sector, we aren't nearly as transparent as we need to be, ought to be, and have to be going forward. I'll give you just one example. Some of you have heard the Foundation Center. It created a program called Glass Pockets, which was an effort to get foundations to voluntarily disclose information about board composition, staff composition, grant priorities, where dollars go. Of the thousands and thousands of foundations in the United States, fewer than 100 have voluntarily signed up to participate in Glass Pockets. And it's all of the usual suspects there. How many foundations only have P.O. boxes that you can't find, you can't identify, you can't connect to? That is not a sustainable or a desirable place to be. So I do think that we are in some jeopardy unless we step up and try to be as transparent as we can about how we operate, what we do, where grants go, how those decisions get made. And I think that that is the best antidote to regulation. And I think as a field, we're way behind on that curve.
It's also interesting to think that it's a bit of reframing, right? That philanthropy is stewarding the public's social capital, the public's wealth. I mean, this is money that would otherwise be taxed, and the government would ultimately decide how to allocate to social programs. And I think a lot of people haven't fundamentally shifted their mindset to understand that I'm just the steward of this capital. I'm not the owner anymore of this capital. And so I think once you shift your mindset to doing what's best for the social good, I think it fundamentally shifts the accountability and transparency argument, because it's not my special interest dollars. It's about what's best for the community at large.
Yeah.
I'm going to pause for 1 minute, read an announcement. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're discussing the growing power of philanthropic institutions. Our guests are Dr. David Callahan, founder of the Demos Think Tank and InsidePhilanthropy.com, and author of the new book, The Givers, Money, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age, and Dr. Emmett Carson, president of the Silicon Valley Community Foundation. I'm Nick Tedesco, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel, and find the club on Twitter and Facebook. David, did you want to jump in on that question?
Well, since we are talking about accountability and transparency, in a conversation with the head of the largest community foundation in the United States, I have to say that one of the things that many people are concerned about, many reform-minded people are concerned about, is the explosion of donor-advised funds, which have less transparency and no payout requirements compared to private foundations. For those of people who don't know how this system operates, donor-advised funds are basically held by public charities, which do not have to report who is making, at least publicly, who is making the gifts. They report where those gifts go, but you don't know where the money is coming from. So I, as a journalist, when I write about the Silicon Valley Community Foundation or other DAFs, I can see where their gifts are going, but I don't know who's making them, which makes it a little difficult to do my work as a reporter trying to bring transparency to the sector. Another problem with DAFs is that they don't have payout requirements. You can end in while DAFs overall do a great job, in fact, of payout. Individually, you can get your tax deduction by putting a bunch of money in a DAF and make no payouts for theoretically forever, or some extended period of time. I think that when the regulatory regime around the private foundation was created, the regulators got it right, which is that there's a compact here. Money goes in, you know where it's coming from, you know where it's going, and when money goes in, there is an agreement that it will go out, which is the payout. That 5%, now 5% payout, it used to be higher. There's debates of whether it should be higher or lower, but there is a payout requirement. That basic public compact behind institutional philanthropy, I think, is in jeopardy with the growing rise in power of DAFs.
So, we create false boogeymen sometimes. And I agree that sunlight is always valuable. So let's start with the first issue about knowing who made the grant. Silicon Valley Community Foundation has something called a grants catalog. You can go on our website. You can see where every grant goes, how much, who got it. What you cannot see is what donor made the grant. Now, why do we think that's important? Because I think that's important because if a donor made a grant to Planned Parenthood, they shouldn't have protesters at their house the next day. They ought to be able to make that grant to Planned Parenthood. They ought to be able to make that grant to whatever organization that is a legitimate 501c3 organization. And the public interest is served by knowing that that grant went to that organization. I don't know that the public interest is served by knowing who made that specific grant. We've made several grants recently to Muslim organizations and have come under attack by some right-wing groups attacking me personally, attacking the institution because of these grants. I can't imagine an individual family having to live with that assault on them daily for making a grant because they had a set of values. So I think there are good, strong, and legitimate reasons for saying, yes, you need to know that the grant was made. You need to know the organization that got it. But Mr. and Mrs. Smith are deserving of their personal privacy for what they felt they wanted to write a grant to. That there's no public interest served other than the want to attack them for having made that grant. On the issue of payout, our smaller funds, and our funds start at $5,000, make SSF payout of 80 to 90%. Our largest funds, over $1 million, have payout of 16% on average. So a payout of 5%, just as happened with private foundations, may well induce people to give a lot less than to give a lot more. We also make that data available. But I agree, you can have the compact. You can have the discussion about payout. That is a legitimate and good public interest discussion to have. But you should not create an ecosystem where the payout rate that you require of donor-advised funds is substantially different from what you ask of private foundations. I don't know why you would tilt it one way or the other in a philanthropic ecosystem of giving. But understand that our payout rates uniformly, Congressional Research Service has looked at this, Urban Institute has looked at this, Congressional Budget Office has looked at this, and they have all concluded that the payout rates of donor-advised funds substantially exceed the 5% payout of private foundations.
I think once ordinary Americans realize that billionaires can stash all this money without it there being
a requirement. But they're not stashing. That's a loaded word, stashing and parking. No, they're giving. And that's what the data shows. So let's not go alternative facts at the end. Let's go real facts.
But it's true that under the law, the assumption is that if you give money to a 501c3 charity and get that tax deduction, it will go to charitable purposes. Emin is right, DAFs have great payouts right now. But there is a massive loophole here sitting in our charitable infrastructure. And as I said, I mean, remember what happened in the 1960s. When it becomes more, when the public starts paying more attention and they realize what sort of loopholes exist, whatever, you know, whatever the data from may actually show, I think things could get ugly.
I'm curious what your response is on the transparency question. At what level should there be the transparency? Do you believe that it should be? Or, you know, are we hearing calls from the sector for it to be on the personal level? You know, and to Emmett's point, does that kind of eliminate privacy raise a number of concerns?
Yeah, I mean, and I certainly understand Emmett's concerns. And I suggest that, you know, that there... I'm mainly concerned about there being transparency around large gifts that intend to influence public policy just like I want that kind of transparency around campaign donations. Basically, all of the thinking around campaign funding, I think, is relevant to the funding that goes to philanthropy. If people don't want, Emmett said democracy is messy. I think if you're not prepared, you know, numerous nonprofit organizations, all the people who work at Planned Parenthood, all the executives, they're all known to the public. All the private foundations that fund them transparently, they're all known to the public. You know, if individual donors can't take the heat, they shouldn't be making those gifts. And I also think that bad things happen when people behave anonymously. And in a civil society, discourse can go downhill when people can hide behind a curtain with a megaphone. You want to see what this looks like? Just look at a Twitter. Look at Twitter, where you can have fake handles. Look at the comments in the discussion and the bottom of articles where people have handles. And we see more and more in philanthropy that kind of bad behavior coming with anonymous donations. All that money for climate denial work for years, that all went, much of it, through donor-advised funds. I look in my book at an operation called Donors Trust, which has pumps $100 million in anonymously to organizations seeking to influence public policy. All the money that
but
is sought,
not, but
all
it's
the,
not anonymous. You know
where
who,
it's going. Yes, I know that
who
it's going.
Got it.
I know that it's
you
going.
You know who got it.
Right. I know that it's
so
going to fund.
So knowing Mr. and Mrs. Smith made it allows you to do what now? Mr. and Mrs. Smith that live on Main Street made the gift. Now you do what with that information? Now that you know that they gave it. What do you do?
I think.
You attack. You use social media. You want to know so I can get after them. I want to know so I can boycott their business. I want to know so I can harass their kid. You know where the money went. You know who got it. You know what their purpose was.
I don't know that. But I don't know if I don't know whether it's ExxonMobil. You know, one of the top scholars who tracked all the work that went for climate denial. He noticed that the Kochs and ExxonMobil stopped giving transparently. And then the money trail ended. Meanwhile, all this new money started coming in to Donors Trust and other institutions for this work.
But
these are interested donors.
When you know the donor's name, what does that allow you to do differently?
Well, in the case of corporations, it allows shareholders to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe you, the executive, shouldn't be doing that.
Okay, but in the case of the individual?
I want to know who is speaking with a megaphone in the public square, just like I want to know who's behind
what,
the Twitter.
Just want to know for knowledge sake.
I think that people behave.
Once you know, that's all. I just want to know they live there.
Emmett, I think people behave. I think people behave better. I think people behave better in civil society when they have to be accountable to the opinions they express.
And I think it will have a chilling effect.
Maybe that's
on
a good
thing.
Maybe that's a good
that
thing.
I both care about.
Maybe
and
there's
the
too much
I
shouting
I
in the public square.
I don't think
by
there's
by
enough
by
shouting
dollars.
In the public square.
Well, we will.
Well, we're shouting here. So that's
it's not Harley.
This is a great debate, and I will ask one last question. I think to end on. One last question, brief comments from both of you on this before we close. And this came from the audience. Where do we see the sector in 20, 30 years?
I think we're going to continue to see a kind of supersizing of the sector. The giving pledge wealth, waiting, that's much of it still on the sidelines, is going to come in a much bigger way. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, between them, for all the giving they've done already, have $150 billion that they have not yet touched, that they have dedicated to philanthropy. The Forbes 400 list has a combined net worth of $2.5 trillion dollars. A lot of those people have signed the giving pledge. This money is going to come in a big way. And importantly, and this is a key theme of my book, it's going to come in at a time that the fiscal screws are going to be tightening on government more and more, with discretionary spending being cut and cut and cut, who's ever in office. Whether Trump's draconian discretionary spending cuts go through or not, it's going to be a downward slope for government having extra money hanging around to try new things and new initiatives, send a man to Mars, cure this disease, or whatever. Because of the retirement of the baby boomers, all the public debt that needs to be serviced. And so we're going to see philanthropy rise while government declines. And I think that poses really profound challenges for our democracy and how we, you know, make decisions and solve problems as a society, which is one reason why it's so important to have these conversations now about regulation, about oversight, and about accountability.
Just one, I want to thank the Commonwealth Club. I want to thank David and Nick. We are witnessing the dawn of a rise of a new age of American renaissance in philanthropy. It's going to be incredible. As David said, there's so much money that is going to come online by people who want to do good. These are people, right? There are a lot of other people who take these resources and they spend them on themselves. So we ought to celebrate this small slice of people who actually want to take these resources and are pledging to give them away. That is an exciting time of a lot of opportunities with big ideas and big transformations. So I, for one, I'm excited about what this future looks like. It's fraught with challenges and concerns, as every period has had. But I can't think of a time where we haven't needed more wealth to come online to be available to support causes when we worry about things every day, from education to healthcare to infrastructure, and that there are people who are saying they want to step forward and contribute substantially to some of those solutions. I think that is a much better solution and place to be than people who want to hoard it and pass it on generationally for themselves and their families. By pledging to give it away.
I think that's the perfect note to end on. Our thanks to David Callahan, founder of Demos Think Tank and InsidePhilanthropy.com, and author of the new book, The Givers, Money, Power, and Philanthropy in a Gilded Age, and Dr. Emmett Carson, president of the Silicon Valley Community Foundation. We also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the internet. And lastly, we also wish to remind everyone that there are copies of David's book for sale. He'll be glad to sign them following the program. I'm Nick Tedesco, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.